Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Brought to you by Lexus. Some things do more than their stated functions, because exceptional things inspire you to do exceptional things. To this select list, we add the all-new Lexus GX. With its exceptional capability, you'll see possibilities you never knew existed, sending you far outside your comfort zone. But as much as the GX challenges you, it also spoils you. Its intuitive technology and luxurious features mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to it. The all-new Lexus GX.
This is The Guardian.
All right, polls, guys, do we believe them?
The bit I believe is the 30% of people still undecided or voting for others or independents.
Hello, lovely Potters. You're on Australian Politics. I'm Catherine Murphy, and with me this week,
Josh Butler,
Paul Karp,
Sarah Martin, and
Amy Remakis.
And
we are answering your campaign questions.
We are going to answer your campaign questions, and they are, as usual, excellent. Sarah, you're up first. So this week we're going to start with a question from Lisa Johnson. Thank you, Lisa. She says, it seems the LNP has abandoned its moderate faction MPs in favour of dog whistling to the right-wing Conservatives in this election. If they lose with this strategy, aren't they risking sending themselves to Coventry with the voting public? That's the first opener. And there's another one from Jack Saman. I hope I've pronounced that correctly, Jack. Sorry if I haven't. Both leaders have said they won't negotiate with independents in the event of a hung parliament. Is this just talk, or is there a real chance we could be forced back to the polls? Yay! Sorry. If neither party can form a majority government agreement. Thank you both for those questions. Sarah, kicking off
Lisa. Lisa, I think that you're probably asking this question with particular reference to the Catherine Deaves sort of ongoing saga that we've been hearing about over the past couple of weeks, and that sort of particularly the sort of moderate right-wing split has been particularly apparent with people in New South Wales coming out and criticising her and calling for her to be disendorsed while Morrison has stood by her. I think you are right that the Prime Minister is definitely backing the conservative view on this and is ignoring the pleas from those moderates. And we obviously reported that there's been private pleas from sitting MPs like Trent Zimmerman, who are worried that this is a distraction for them to hold on to their, you know, what are known as teal seats, where they're being challenged by Climate 200-backed independents. So, I think you're right that that's the decision that Morrison has made, and obviously very deliberately so. There's a lot of debate as to whether or not he's quite happy to have this little culture war on the side, and he certainly hasn't, you know, he sort of very softly criticised some of Catherine Deaves's commentary, but more or less he has backed her in 100% and said that he pretty much shares her view. He's made no attempt to shut down the issue and is very happy to have it sort of simmering along, I think, because I think their assessment is that it possibly helps them in certain seats, and they always quite enjoy having a little culture war on the side. So if they abandon those teal seats completely, there's a lot of debate as to whether or not that is a strategic shift for the conservative side of politics, and whether there's sort of a long-term goal in mind where, you know, we're seeing in this election, they believe they can flip some traditional Labor-held seats, Hunter, for example, some of those working-class seats that have always been in Labor hands. So there's certainly some within the culture Coalition who think that is the way for the government to go, and that would mean abandoning those inner city seats. And that's obviously the view that some have, is it's how Boris Johnson has been successful in the UK with the sort of so-called red wall strategy. You know, there's mixed views about whether or not there's equivalence in Australia and enough seats for them to be able to do that. Mm. But it's certainly the case that there are some who think that's the way to go. So does it risk sending them to Coventry? I guess we'll see. Whether this strategy with Morrison's focus on the outer suburbs and regional areas is one that pays dividends for them electorally, or whether or not if they do lose those Teal seats and it's a result of losing those Teal seats that they can't form government, perhaps they'll reassess.
Mm. Perhaps.
And then, sorry, Jack, was it Jack's question?
Yes.
About, there's no way they're not going to negotiate with independents if it means they have a chance to form government. That one's easy.
Yeah, I think that's the safest bet in politics at the moment, regardless of what they're saying. Before we move on, any other thoughts either on replicating Boris Johnson's, red wall?
It was Labor's red wall, the traditional sort of working class seats.
No, I'm sure that is the terminology. Yeah. I just doubted myself for a minute. So either red wall or whether or not there is some prospect of having another election this year.
As if they would have another election this year. Like, it's just ludicrous. I mean, like, there is, I guess, that sort of thought that, like, maybe those independents wouldn't sign, like, a formal coalition with a small C rather than the big C. Of, you know, Labor and the Greens and some sort of cobbled together little faction that, you know, give them supply and confidence, but they, you know, negotiate day by day on day by day stuff of Parliament. But as if Scott Morrison and Anthony Albanese are going to go through this whole thing, and like, yeah, Anthony Albanese has been working for 26 years to be the Prime Minister, and he's one seat away, and he goes, "Oh no, I won't.
Yeah, actually,
I won't make a deal with Zali Steggall or with whoever." Like,
yeah, it is silly.
And Adam Bandt has actually ruled that out, going back to the polls.
Oh, yes, which is interesting, good point.
Because, the Labor are saying absolutely no deals with the Greens, and even in that circumstance, Bandt isn't prepared to make that threat. So I think that's a pretty good indication.
Safe bet. Okay. All right. Paul, you're up. So from Caitlin Scamp, hi, Murph, and everybody. What is the significance of Albo winning the Sky News debate in Queensland, a conservative news channel in a conservative state? So that's Caitlin's question, obviously referencing the first leaders' debate of the campaign, which happened on Wednesday night. Yes, on Sky TV. So we'll deal with that in a tick, Caitlin. And from Dave Madden, Labor could be running a much more negative campaign. For example, drawing more attention to recent blue-on-blue attacks. Why do you think they're not doing this? And will it come later?
Well, I might start there because they have started their negative ads just today on Thursday.
It's almost like you willed it, Dave. I mean, almost like, you know, just by asking us the question, the ads turned up. Anyway, sorry, go on.
They have started the ads. They're on free-to-air and digital. And basically it's a roll call of Morrison mistakes, including, you know, bushfires, being on holiday in Hawaii, vaccines, rapid antigen tests.
Greatest hits.
But more than just reminding people of the mistakes, the ad argues that, yes, you know, bad things will happen and mistakes will happen, but the difference is, you know, a leader will take responsibility, and Morrison has shown that he won't. And then it runs, you know, him saying, "That's not my job," a number of times, and looking very smug in the last one. So there are negative ads that are running now. And this reflects, feedback that you, Murph, and we've all heard about. It's persuading more voters in those marginal seats to be arguing Morrison is not up to the job, rather than to, you know, Labor doesn't have a big policy platform. Albanese is still relatively unknown, so they're not trying to win the election that way. In terms of whether they should be looking at blue-on-blue violence and splits within the Liberal Party, I think they just let those issues run, and people can see that division, and there's no point Labor pouring petrol on that because there are so many better things to attack, like all the things that are in the ad. In terms of the first question about the debate, yes, you might think, you know, Sky News and Queensland, that would be you know, rough terrain for Anthony Albanese. But if you look at what the voters actually chose to ask him, it was quite a home ground advantage, quite friendly.
Yeah, it was interesting that.
Questioning for Labor. I mean, people were mainly asking about the quality of government services. So there was an aged care question. There was the National Disability Insurance Scheme cuts question. There were several questions about integrity, either generally or specifically about the need for an anti-corruption body. And those are things that are generally Labor strengths, that Labor had, you know, more policy to announce in those areas. There was only one question on foreign policy, and it was about the stuff up of the fact that China has a deal with Solomon Islands. And there was none really on the macro economy. It was Scott Morrison that was constantly driving the conversation back to the macro economy by arguing that if you don't have a strong economy, then you can't pay for the government services. So the questioning was actually quite benign for Anthony Albanese, and that was an advantage to him. I do think that's why he won. And not many people are going to be watching a debate that's on cable TV news anyway. And more important than, you know, the very narrow 40-35 win with 25 undecided, more important is how it plays into the news cycle.
Yes.
And how it plays into the news cycle is, after a horrible first week, you know, Anthony Albanese gaffe-free encounter, or, you know, one minor slip-up on boat turnbacks that he corrected during the debate.
Yeah.
Whereas Scott Morrison had a day or two of bad coverage about it because of the, you know, the blessed comment about being blessed that, you know, his children had, you know, don't have a disability, or that he didn't have to navigate the NDIS.
Yes. I think, too, just to be clear, because I think the viewership figures came in, I think there was about 175,000 people who watched the first debate of the campaign. So obviously, you know, that, well, I mean, it's a lot of people, but in TV terms, it's nobody. Also, just in case you didn't watch it and you've never seen the format, the debate format on Sky News, because there's always at least one Sky debate during the election campaign, just bear in mind this isn't a situation where the sort of Sky After Dark roster turns up and just slugs everybody with questions. It's an audience of undecided voters, and you know, they ask the questions. So, and as Paul said, you know, the questions on Wednesday night were, in policy terms, favourable to Albanese and Labor because they're in areas of his strengths. Anyway, I just thought we better say that because so few people actually watched it. So, Josh, you're up. You've got three questions. First from Peter Bragg. Has the candidate for Warringah committed to any interviews or press conferences where her views can be explained and subject to scrutiny? If not, why not? Then your next question is from Helen Lewis. Again, Helen, I hope I've pronounced your name correctly. Helen asks, why are the Greens mostly not being referenced by MSM? And by that, I do hate that acronym, but that means mainstream media. Thank you, Josh. During the lead up to the election, including by the ABC, they're the third largest party, could get balance of power in the Senate. They represent about 12% of Australian voters. Why so disregarded? And your third question is from Jonathan Foy. Hello, Jonathan. How will the AEC be taking into account COVID when it comes to how this election is run? Good question, Jonathan. Anyway, Josh, fire away.
Well, they're three good ones, and I'll go through them. I guess we'll start with Warringah. Not that I've seen. I don't think she's made any sort of big personal comments. Like, she's given out a lot of written comments, and they've all been sorry for my past tweets, and I apologise, and I've deleted them, and she keeps putting out that statement every other day when someone else finds some old tweets from her. There was a candidates forum that she was meant to go to two nights ago, I think, that she pulled out of a debate or a forum of some kind. There's been all these, like the Sydney Morning Herald's been following her around, and there was some, I think, fundraising dinner or something that she was supposed to, that she went to, and at like a private home, and they like smuggled her in the back of a car, and there's all these great photos in the Sydney Morning Herald. Like, they must have been on like the roof of the house across the road or something like that, and there's these like, you know, paparazzi shots sort of through the balcony or something like that of this woman, you know, bundled in the back of a car, and you know they drove her into the garage so that she wouldn't.
Nicole Kidman style.
Yeah, or it was like Taylor Swift in the box or something. Like it was smuggled her out of the apartment. I don't know. Like I think. She's just, you know, they don't want her anywhere near a camera, I don't think. Like she's posting a fair bit on Facebook and she's posting photos of her out and about shaking hands with people on the campaign hustings, but I don't think we'll see her near a camera or anything anytime soon. I'm just going to back through the rest of those questions.
Yeah, no,
the Greens question. Yeah, the Greens is a good one. The 12% thing I think is interesting because their numbers, as much as you can put store and news poll and that sort of thing, their numbers have bounced around a bit. I think they were at 12 in the last one, but they were as low as like 9 or 8, I think, a couple of weeks ago. So, you know, that's a fair change in a couple of weeks. The question about why they're not getting more coverage, I think it's because everyone is so focused on this election where it could be a change of government in the House of Representatives, and the Greens have one MP in the House of Representatives at this point. Like I said, obviously they are talking very much about their potential to hold the balance of power in the Senate. They want to pick up a few more seats. They're talking about, I think they've got 9 seats at the moment, and they're talking about, you know, wanting to get as many as 12 in the Senate, which will be what they say is their biggest representative number they've ever had. I think the biggest third party, I think it would be the biggest third party outside of Labor and Liberal ever, which would be a big deal. But I mean, that's not certain. It's not definite.
No. But I was just trying to think about the Democrats, but I'm too feeble brained to think that far back.
I think we spoke about this a couple of weeks ago on different podcasts, but like the Greens always talk a big game at each election. They've only ever had this one MP in the lower house. But even today, I just saw that, again, talk about polling, and this was a Greens poll. The Greens say that they might have a really, really, really good crack in Griffith, which is a Labor-held seat in Brisbane. They reckon they've done all these tens of thousands of door knocks, and they've done this polling based on that, and I haven't seen the polling, so let's take it with a grain of salt. But they said they've done this similar type of polling previously with like some of their state candidates, and it's been almost, you know, bang on what the final result turns out to be. So, that seat's, I think, on a 2 or 3% margin for Terry Butler up there. So, I mean, you know, I think Amy's shaking her head here, but I mean,
we'll hear from Amy on this.
It's really interesting. I think that would be one that they are really confident of picking up, but obviously we'll see. There's a long way to go in the election. The AEC stuff, COVID-wise, I think some of this stuff will change because we're seeing New South Wales and Victoria and I think also the ACT changing COVID isolation rules in the last couple of days and in the next couple of days, I think, for the ACT. The AEC have been talking a lot about massively boosting mobile voting, phone polling, that sort of thing. So I think there'll be some changes to that. But, you know, obviously they're very mindful there might be a lot of people in isolation or sick or in hospital or what have you than in previous years. They're also talking about a lot of really basic stuff like, you know, all these hundreds of thousands of bottles of hand sanitizer they're giving out at polling places and more pencils and pens and what have you. So I think it'll be a really interesting one to see what happens with the AEC this time around.
Yeah, okay, all good. I guess about the Liberal candidate in Warringah, I totally agree with your analysis that they don't want her anywhere near a camera, but am I the only one who senses there might be a controlled detonation of the candidate at some point in the not-too-distant future? By that I mean she may bob up with an interview in a favourable news outlet in order to address your point.
You'd have
point.
To, yeah. I mean,
well,
like,
I don't know. I'm speculating and I'm making clear, obviously, to listeners that we're recording this episode on Thursday afternoon and the episode will drop on Saturday. So,
Before the front page of the Daily Telegraph.
Well, I'm just curious, right, because it's sort of like there is this problem, as Josh says, right, we've got this high-octane ridiculousness of, you know, treating this candidate like she's, you know, a Hollywood celebrity kind of under a blanket in the back of the car. At some point, one imagines she will have to be put out somewhere.
Yeah, anyway. Well, like, how do you get her out of witness protection? Like, well, you can't be there forever.
That's the point.
There was also the suggestion in the press conference today with the Prime Minister that it was the Liberal campaign which was silencing their Warringah candidate, not the public. And Scott Morrison was asked directly, is this true? And he didn't answer it.
Yeah.
So he, you know, he used a lot of his usual lines about, you know, supporting the candidate, having been in touch with the candidate, but he didn't actually say whether it was the Liberals themselves who were not allowing Catherine Deaves to speak.
To speak, yes, very good point.
And on Griffiths.
And yes, oh, no, no, well, hang on. We've got to introduce Amy properly. Amy's got a bunch of questions coming up and she's also going to have thoughts on Griffith because I think she'll explode if she doesn't. But I just...
Only the Queenslander in
but,
me, that's
but
all.
No. We understand that, darling. But first and foremost, because Amy's been away for a few months, I just want to welcome her back to the live blog coverage, which, of course, is magnificent as always, and back to the hive mind that is this political team in Canberra. So Amy's up. Start with Griffith Dales and then we'll do your question.
Okay, on Griffith, and I'm not disputing anything that Josh said, the Greens always think they can win Griffith. It's kind of the same as points that Sarah has made about Boothby in Adelaide, where Labor always thinks that they can win Boothby and it always ends up being the status quo. It's the same with Griffith.
It's good to have big dreams.
I think the difference with Boothby is that people in Adelaide never think they can win Boothby. It's people at HQ who occasionally think that they can win Boothby. But this time it's a bit different for Boothby.
I mean, like, the Greens have increased their vote in Queensland. They now have a state representative in the parliament for the first time. So, you know, they have taken a seat in that area in Griffith. They took it from Jackie Trad, who is, you know, quite closely aligned with Terry Butler, which has given a bit of impetus to this push. But at the moment on the ground, there doesn't seem to be that much of a scare within the Labor campaign that they are going to lose Griffith. There's always that worry, but it doesn't seem to be translating to the point where they're battening down the hatches.
Mm. Okay, very interesting. Now, Amy, you've got two questions. The first is on aged care, and this is from Nola Chilcott. Hi, Nola. My parents had an ACAT assessment over 6 months ago and received a level 3 assessment for their home care package. It has still not been processed. My mum is 90 in July. Hello, Nola's mum. Why is home care taking so long and what assistance is there for my parents now? That's your first question. Obviously, mm-hmm. we don't need to get into the weeds mm-hmm. of ACAT assessments, but we get the drift. The second question is from Ginger, and it concerns the Solomons that we referenced a minute or two ago, and this security pact that it has been struck with China. So Ginger says, the Solomons, this is a game changer in the Pacific. What has the foreign minister been doing?
Well, isn't that a question for the ages? I'll start with Nola. Hi, Nola. I'm sorry that you and your family are going through this. It's something that thousands of Australian families are going through at the moment. And the very short answer to your question is, why is your mum not receiving the home care package she's been approved for? Is because of staffing shortages. There just isn't the staff to be able to enact all of these home care packages that have been, awarded to people, rightly awarded to people. And Chris Nowse did a great story on this very recently for The Guardian, where he basically was pointing out that of the $6.5 billion that the federal government promised for an extra 80,000 home care packages over the next couple of years, staff shortages has meant that the vast majority of those are not being met as yet. He actually reported that the total number of home care providers has actually decreased in the past year by about 17, which doesn't seem like a lot. But if you're in an area outside of metropolitan, like cities, that could be the only provider that you had in your region.
Yeah.
Or it might have meant that you went from two providers to one. And that's huge when you consider the growing number of people who need care at home. So it's one of those issues that has kind of been popping up in the election campaign, but not to the level that it should, in that we keep hearing questions to the Labor campaign of how they're going to meet all their promises for extra nursing staff in terms of the urgent care clinics that they have promised and the melanoma clinics, and putting a registered nurse in every aged care home 24 hours, 7 days a week, as the Royal Commission recommended. But we're not seeing those same questions applied to the government, to the coalition, about how they are going to meet what is already a staffing shortage in the care sector generally, but particularly in aged care. This is a massive issue for Australia. It's not going to be solved just by bringing in more foreign carers. It does need to have a lot more training and money and time put into this sector, and we're just not seeing those commitments at the moment.
Yes, and whichever side of power wins on the 21st, it's a huge issue. So thank you, Nola, for that question. Now to Ginger and the Solomons.
To Ginger and the Solomons. Where was Maurice Payne? Well, Maurice Payne, to be fair, as Daniel Hurst and Kate Lyons have reported, has been in contact with her Solomon Island counterpart. Where was she while this was all happening, when Zed Zeselja was sent? She was on the campaign. And we know that Maurice Payne was on the campaign because her own people have been sending out photos of Maurice Payne at campaign events. Andrew Clennell from Sky News asked the Prime Minister why Maurice Payne was at a LNP fundraiser on the day that Zed Zeselja was flown out to Solomon Islands. Wasn't particularly an answer for that. Again, we've just fallen back on the, we've been in constant contact and we're doing everything that we can. But I think given the US response and who they have sent, like they're sending their big diplomatic guns with Kurt Campbell. We've had a lot of interest from the United States, I suppose. Even New Zealand has certainly, you know, popped up in this space as well. There's going to be a lot of questions, I think, about whether an election campaign got in the way of Australia's diplomatic response to this.
Yes, indeed. Now, we're on the clock, guys, so we're going to freeform a couple real fast. I wanted them on the list of questions today because they're very substantial questions, and they're issues that are not really necessarily front and centre in what's happening in the election campaign at the moment. From a Twitter account called Just Science, this observation: we're in transition from no COVID vaccination to high vaccination with better prophylactics. Has any politician laid out what that pathway looks like? Potential mortality has gone from 40,000 a year to less than 8,000 a year, and dropping as the various waves diminish. Asking a question for the ages again, are we there yet when it comes to the pandemic? So that's one we'll freeform on. And also from Peter Stapleton, this is actually about opinion polling, which I think is an important thing to keep front and centre, given that none of us are absolutely certain that the data that we're collecting during the election is 100% accurate. So Peter observes, I think progress has been made on improving the national 2PP, this is two-party preferred number, in terms of accounting for undecideds, and that's referencing our process at Guardian Essential, but I think there's still too much focus on it. What are things looking like at the state level as things are things moving in the right places for a change of government? A very acute question. So anyway, COVID, are we there yet, guys?
No, we're not. I mean, we're certainly seeing, obviously there's changes in restrictions for New South Wales and Victoria, and there's obviously a lot of talk about us moving from the pandemic stage to the endemic stage of the virus. Certainly doesn't mean it's not harmless, but it does mean that we will live with it in a different way than how we have over the past couple of years. I also feel like even if we do have another difficult wave over winter, I don't feel that there'd be any public appetite at all for reintroduction of restrictions. Governments will be treating it in a very different way as well.
This is the question I've got. Yeah, it's kind of like if there is all of a sudden God forbid, some horrendous variant, you know, what do governments do then?
Have we heard? I hadn't really thought about this until the question. I haven't heard a single politician talk about this on the election yet.
That's why I put it on the question roster.
This thing that's been around in our lives for two and a half years.
It's amazing.
I haven't heard a single question about it. Like, you see, obviously, people wearing masks at press conferences and that sort of thing, but I haven't heard any politicians even be asked a question or say anything about it.
I think everyone's just sick of talking.
Because I think the lockdowns, which are sort of unprecedented, were until we had a vaccine, and then there was a vaccine, and then most people, 90% plus, got vaccinated, and then they feel they've done their part, they've done all they can, and then the social license for those, you know, other things that are huge impositions just falls away. Mm. Now, maybe we still should be doing things like masks that aren't a great imposition.
And for the record, we are fully masked and ventilated in this recording.
in a room the size of a cupboard.
We should be doing those things. But, yeah, it's completely dropped off the radar, even though, you know, more than 4,000 people have died this year, which is, you know, more than double in the first 2 years of the pandemic. But no, it's not really an issue. I think we just sort of, the political conversation has moved into the endemic stage where they're just going to cop that amount.
Having said that, on today, this Thursday, Philadelphia in the United States is reintroducing mask mandates for inside because their cases are starting to get out of control again, and there's too much pressure on the healthcare system already, and they're just trying to get ahead of the wave. And I kind of feel that the United States is starting to look at doing that, even though, of course, they have their own court issues and all the rest of it. I think we could start to see some mandates in terms of masks and things like that if our healthcare systems are not standing up to any future COVID outbreaks.
Yeah, well, it's sort of the key question about winter, isn't it, really? Like whether the combo of flu season and COVID plus any variants sort of changes the calculation. But anyway, we foregrounded this question because it is important and bizarrely, despite, you know, this being the collective obsession of the world for the last, you know, 2 years, it's all of a sudden we've hit this fatigue point.
But both sides are kind of saying, oh, there's sunnier days ahead, you know, like neither of them want to say, you know,
think back to this awful time.
I mean, like Labor's obviously talking about, you know, failures on vaccines or what have you, but like they don't want to talk about masks and lockdowns and, you know, doom and gloom.
Yeah, exactly. All right, polls, guys, do we believe them?
The bit I believe is the 30% of people still undecided or voting for others or independents.
Yeah, I think, like, honestly, I think, you know, the lesson we've applied corporately at The Guardian is watch the undecideds, foreground the undecideds in every piece of research that you see. But Peter raised a really interesting point, and that is, you know, this sort of weird situation that we've got in Australia because data is so, well, poor, let's be honest. You know, we make much of the national metrics in opinion polls, right? What is the national two-party preferred, or in our poll, two-party preferred plus, tells you bugger all, actually, about what's happening, because what's happening is happening state by state and seat by seat. And yet nobody is producing reliable seat polls that would enable us to be able to accurately chart the trajectory of an election. So, you know, I don't know. Has anyone seen any decent seat pulse or, you know, some innovation that would help us in this regard?
No, and I think the thing people have to keep in mind is that swings are never uniform. So even if there were a uniform swing of 3% nationally, you're going to see seats further up the pendulum fall on margins larger than 3%. And you can see that in where the leaders are campaigning. I mean, Anthony Albanese was in Bennelong today trying to, you know, because John Alexander's retiring and they think that's a winnable seat, even though it's on a larger margin. You can look at the coalition's list that they're briefing out about how they're going to retain government by winning, you know, Lyons, McEwen, seats that are on 5% margins that they hope to go the other way. So, you know, they know that it's not just, you know, a dozen seats in play. There are more seats in play than that. And I think the state story is going to be very interesting, particularly when WA, you know, polls closed last. They're a few hours behind. Reports a few hours later, but that is looking like the most fertile ground for Labor potentially, with three seats on a margin of about 5.5% and less, and expecting a swing.
And then we just saw the Labor campaign spend almost a week in Queensland, which, you know, some of the margins there are just absolutely astronomical, and you wouldn't expect to see any seats really change to Labor given what happened in the last election. But we did just see the Labor campaign dedicate almost a week in Queensland, particularly in southeast Queensland. And there's a reason for that, is because they sense with the floods that there is opportunity for change there. And I do have to say again, as the Queenslander, I know it's seen as a conservative state, but it has had progressive state governments for the vast majority of the last couple of decades. It's not a conservative stronghold. It just really did not like Bill Shorten at the last election.
Mm. Mm. Josh, did you have a thought? No, not particularly.
No, no. Greens have knocked on 20,000 doors in Griffith. But, no, we shouldn't laugh.
No.
That's a really good point. I mean, I've been fascinated in how much both sides, Paul mentioned WA, how much both sides are already pandering to WA. Like, every time Scott Morrison goes over there, he just, you know, falls over to say how much we love WA and, oh, you guys are so good. And
the forever deal.
Oh, the forever deal. Like, and even his, I was fascinated this week that he, again, he's turned around one of these Labor lines and just, like, switch the names out of it. Like, you know, one of Albo's lines the whole way through has been like, Scott Morrison sided with Palmer against WA. And Morrison turned it around this week at, I think, one of the Chamber of Commerce events he was at, and he said, Albo sided against Mark McGowan and West Australians on, I can't remember what the issue was. It was something.
Greenfields, industrial
relations. Oh, yes, industrial relations.
Something about mining, yeah.
That's right.
It was really interesting. Just, you know, it was just one of these ones that kept flipping it around. But, yeah, I think that's a really interesting factor. Like, he's now trying to say, oh, you know, Mark McGowan and me are our best buddies. So
Yeah.
I think the West is interesting because 6 months ago, Labor and the coalition were saying, you know, 5 seats could be in play over there. And that's massively stepped back now. And I know last election, you know, Labor was also pretty confident, but they weren't sure which seat, which was kind of problematic. But now I think both sides are sort of more in the two or three seats.
Paul's agitated.
The individual seat polls suggest, you know, Tangy is in play, which is on a, you know, stonking 10 or 11% margin. So we come back to the original
point that either
those polls are wrong or we're going to see strange things. Josh Frydenberg losing Kooyong, the Liberals losing North Sydney, you know, if they are to be believed, which, you know, I don't think necessarily either. Yeah.
And Murph, your visit to Tasmania and talking to those undecided voters was really interesting because both parties are throwing absolutely everything at it, thinking they have a shot. And what you found was that they're both kind of just like, about both sides.
Mega meh. So anyway, yeah, look, it is, anyway, genuinely fascinating. Now, last one, Paul, very quickly, just because you did the fact check. I've dubbed you in for this one because you did the fact check on it. When Morrison claims, sorry, this is from an account called Truth Seeker. When Morrison claims that he saved 40,000 lives, what modelling is he using to prove that direct intervention by the federal government only achieved this? Does this assume no vaccines? Does it assume that he influenced the state's management? Where did this number come from?
So this number is comparing the number of deaths in Australia in 2020 and 2021 with the average in the OECD. If we had had that average applied to our population, we would have had, you know, 40,000 deaths. So that's how it's calculated. Morrison doesn't exactly say, you know, I personally saved these lives or only through the federal government's actions were these lives saved.
What do you mean he doesn't say that?
He says, you know, the Australian pandemic response did that and then leaves it implicit that, you know, brackets, that means me, folks. So obviously the federal government did some things like closing the borders and convening national cabinet and ordering vaccines. It didn't drive every aspect of the COVID response. The states drove, you know, the lockdowns and a lot, and the interstate border closures that kept parts of the country relatively COVID free for that whole 2 years. So it's not a Morrison solo achievement. It's a federal Australian achievement.
An achievement of the Federation.
Yes.
Yes.
As long as it's understood in that context, then, you know, it's not wrong per se. It is slightly misleading though, because there are a bunch of countries in the OECD like Mexico that we don't normally compare ourselves to. We normally aim to have better medical outcomes then. So there are some countries that didn't have such a great pandemic that drag the OECD
up, not down. Okay, fascinating achievements of the Federation and all that. Well, thank you guys. Thank you to everybody who sent questions this week. Obviously, we cannot get to all of them. I apologise for that, but we hope we've run through a representative sample of things that you really want answered in the campaign context. We'll do another episode, of course, next week. So, you know, put your thinking caps on and keep us on our toes. Thank you to Miles Martin, who's the EP of this show. Thank you to you guys for listening, and we'll see you again next Saturday.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Brought to you by Lexus. Some things do more than their stated functions, because exceptional things inspire you to do exceptional things. To this select list, we add the all-new Lexus GX. With its exceptional capability, you'll see possibilities you never knew existed, sending you far outside your comfort zone. But as much as the GX challenges you, it also spoils you. Its intuitive technology and luxurious features mean that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to it. The all-new Lexus GX.